The Brad Sessmatt Show, broadcasting live.
Hey, hey, welcome on in to Thursday, the Brad Sessmatt Show. I'm Jordan Spurgeon, filling in, the big guy, traveling the country right now. Hope Brad's having a good time unplugging and doing his thing. But there's a lot happening here in the Valley. Crazy, crazy week. High school football is heating up. College football, Big 12 opener for ASU. At home coming up this weekend against Kansas. That's going to be a big matchup. You'll see Jordan Hamm out there. You'll see Eliav Goodbye down in Tucson. I'll be doing different things. I've got some athletes that I'm talking with that might be hosting a tailgate at ASU. So I'll be bouncing all around as well. So super excited to see what's going to happen with ASU and U of A this weekend. It's going to be exciting. High school football, like I said, we're seeing big time matchups tonight. Red Mountain and Highland, both teams 5-0. Red Mountain's looked like a legit team this year. In the 6A, Highland has looked like a team that could be competing with Liberty in the open division for those that follow it more seriously. If you want more coverage of high school football, The Zone Read with Eric Sorensen drops tonight. Bleacher Talk, the show that me and Claudia Collins host on our platform, dropped yesterday. You can see it on Arizona Family Sports throughout the rest of the week. You can see it on our website. You can find out more about what's going on in Arizona high school football. You know, today I'm really drawn to a couple things, and later in the show, we're going to have Brad Sessmatt. He did catch up with some people before leaving. He's got John Wilner on. He'll be coming up in the next segment here on this show. They talked a lot about what's going on with the Pac-12 and the Mountain West and realignment, and GCU is at the heart of things. They are a mover and shaker, and I know they're moving to the WCC supposedly, but things may be changing faster than even they could have ever imagined. So John Wilner, as always, has more on that with Brad Sessmatt. And then later on in this stream show, Todd Graham and Brad Sessmatt catch up. Todd, you know him from his time at Arizona State, one of the better coaches in program history. So they dive into a lot of things on stuff that's more total college football related, but many topics for Brad and Todd Graham. So that's coming up later in the show. You have that to look forward to. Sylvester's saying hi too, my dog here. He is very interested in what's going on in that world as well. But you know, the one topic that I want to talk about today, maybe it's over talked about at this point, maybe it's not talked about enough, is which of our now three major sports teams are going to win a championship first. We just saw the Arizona Diamondbacks collapse in September and miss the postseason. This was the best roster this team has had, this franchise has had, since arguably 2002, when they were coming off a World Series win and weren't able to get the job done in that following season. You know, they had everything this year, at least on paper. You know, offensively, they had literally, it was the perfect connection of players. Corbin Carroll and Gino Suarez were terrible the first 2.5 months of the season. And the offense still did its thing. They kind of hung in there. And then in the middle of June, they got going. The rest of the team just stayed hot. Jock Peterson, Randall Grichuk were perfect as a DH combo with a lefty and a righty, both with pop, both with swagger, both getting the job done when they needed to. You know, offensively, Jake McCarthy in the outfield really took off this year. So you had him, Gurriel, and Corbin being your three big offensive pieces. Alec Thomas wasn't very good this year. Defensively, though, you could feel the loss of him not being good out there in the outfield, because he is far and away the best center fielder on the team. Corbin Carroll is not a center fielder. He should not be playing center field. I know he's fast. He's a corner outfielder. Jake McCarthy is also a corner outfielder. So they're going to have some decisions to make out in the outfield. And in the infield, you know, guys miss time like Perdomo and Marte at times, but they were solid all year long. So offensively, they had literally everything. And we thought maybe pitching would be solved this year. It wasn't. Injuries happened. I wrote about it in a column. You can't account for that. Jordan Montgomery comes in, you know, at the end of spring training, wasn't ready to go. Could they have done more due diligence to see what he was doing in the offseason before giving him $25 million? Yeah, probably. But you couldn't expect him to be as bad as he was. And like Torrey Lovello has said since, at least he was willing to go to the bullpen and contribute that way down the stretch. And he had a couple nice bullpen appearances throughout the season. So he did something. Eduardo Rodriguez didn't pitch until the end of the season, only made 10 starts. Merrill Kelly missed 3 months. Zach Gallen missed a month. Brandon Fott was your most consistent for a while, but his highs were high. His lows were low. We've seen that a lot through the first 2 years of Brandon Fott. Ryan Nelson came out and was the most consistent pitcher for a while. So Listen, 89 wins is still a 5-win improvement. There's a lot to look forward to with the Arizona Diamondbacks. But as you watch the postseason now, you know, I'm not going to be a homer. I am from San Diego. So, of course, there is a little piece of me that's excited to see what the San Diego Padres are doing. But bias aside, that's the best team in baseball right now. That's the team that's going to win the World Series. If the Diamondbacks had to play them in a 3-game series in the wild card, or a 5-game series in the divisional, or, you know, 7 in the championship series, if they had gotten that far, they weren't winning. Padres have the best pitching in the starting staff with Cease and Musgrove and King and Darvish. Their bullpen is elite, and offensively they have a certain untapped swagger that led them to the best record in baseball throughout the final 2 months. So the Diamondbacks wouldn't have done much in the postseason anyways, but I still think out of the three major teams, I know that's where we started on this, between them, the Suns, and the Cardinals, they're in the best position to win a championship within the next three seasons. Out of all those teams, Arizona's still a mess, the Cardinals. Kyler Murray, is he the answer? Is he not? Remains to be seen. Some weeks everyone's saying he should be an MVP. Other weeks it seems like guys are hopping off the bandwagon. So I'm going to preach patience with Kyler Murray. You know, his deal is already looking like a bargain compared to other quarterbacks. I know it felt overpaid when he first signed, but that's how the quarterback market goes. There's nobody in this class that's exciting enough to want to take. You know, would Quinn Ewers be a guy? No. Cam Ward, maybe, but no one in that class is going to be better than Kyler Murray. Now, if we're having the conversation 2 years from now and they end up with the number one pick and this guy named Arch Manning is there, okay, maybe there's a discussion. Maybe there's a discussion. But for now, the Cardinals, you got to trust that Jonathan Gannon and Monty Austinford are doing the right things. They refuse to spend money on the defense this season, and that's what's going to be costing them. This is a team that very well could have won 8 or 9 games this year, but because of how bad the defense is, specifically with the pass rush, I'm not expecting more than 5, maybe 6 wins this year. And that's just games where Kyler is Kyler doing magical things. That's going to be what it is. So I don't see them being a team in the next couple of years winning a championship. And the Phoenix Suns, you know, they had media day this week. There is a lot of excitement with Coach Budenholzer over at training camp right now. He's done some things. They're going to shoot more threes. You know, one of the best quotes of the day at media day was Bradley Beal when asked about if this team's going to shoot more threes. And he goes, well, we don't have a choice because Bud's going to make us do that. And I think that's something that this team was lacking and missing. You know, I think Frank Vogel is a good coach, but there was just something disconnected last year that he wasn't able to hold these guys accountable. I think Coach Bud is going to be able to hold these guys, and specifically Booker, KD, Bradley Beal, accountable. You bring in a guy like Tyus Jones, you bring in Nurkic, who's maybe already reshaping his game a little bit at the center position for this team because of what Coach Bud wants him to do with playing more defense, playing more pick and roll, and being able to shoot threes in a pick and pop type role as well as already being a really good passer. This team has potential to make a deep run. The West is still deep. You know, Minnesota got worse trading away Carl Anthony Towns this offseason just a couple days ago, but you never know. The Suns, they've got about a year or two to win a championship. So I'm not going to say they won't, but as I said a minute ago, I think the Arizona Diamondbacks are the team to look forward to the most. And it's sports in Arizona. I know. Haven't had a champion in a while outside of the Phoenix Mercury or the Arizona Rattlers. Those two teams and then franchises do win a lot. So we obviously are spoiled with them. But as far as the major three that we have without an NHL team, not a lot of things to look forward to, but I do think I trust the Arizona Diamondbacks and what they're going to do this offseason. Mike Hayes and Torey Lovello, of course, should remain as the GM and the manager of this team and see what happens. And if next year they don't make another 5-win jump to get into that 92 to 94, 95 win range and, you know, compete for the division title and make the playoffs, then yeah, you go look at a guy like Terry Francona who could maybe come out of retirement or someone of that caliber to manage this team. But till then, Torrey's the guy. Mike Hazen's doing a great job building a franchise, building talent on this roster. So that's it. You know, they missed the playoffs. It's baseball. Honestly, they wouldn't have done much. Milwaukee looks good. Maybe they could have snuck past Milwaukee and gotten to Philly. Philly's been the best team in the NL all year. If you sneak past them, good luck with the Padres. You never know, but them being on the outside looking in, it's kind of just how it needed to be, especially with the way they played the final 3 weeks of the season. All right, well, that's enough yapping to me. Coming up next, Brad Sesmat, John Wilner, and then Brad and Todd Graham. See you soon.
John Wilner with us for a couple of minutes. Wilner Hotline, as always, inside and out. John and I are going to talk about things, and in about, what do you think, 15 minutes will be dated? They'll be outgrown. There'll be this new conference, the Pac-18, this, the that. I'm, in all seriousness, John, with everything going on with expansion, now Gonzaga, we talked about it last week, maybe GCU, UTEP goes into the Mountain West. Like, do you see a calm coming, or is this just going to continue to roll?
I think that it will continue to roll. Well, there's a little bit of both. At this point, my sense is that both the Mountain West and the Pac-12 want to find out what their media value is. Both conferences need TV contracts starting in the summer of 2026. They both still have to add at least one full-time member. So the next few months, we're going to have more of this. But then once we get to the other side and they've added their members, then it should calm down. I would have to imagine that things will calm down potentially for a couple of years. All the other conferences are locked in. They have their membership set. They have their TV deals set. If you're looking for what is the next benchmark up ahead, maybe it's February when ESPN has to decide whether to extend the its contract with the ACC. Everybody thinks it's going to do that, which would keep the ACC intact. So I think once we get through these next few months, there could be a prolonged period of calm.
Okay, so I'm going to be the guy that'll disagree with you on this.
Okay.
Okay, so 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, we have the heads of the Pac-12 and the Mountain West that love each other. They're trying to figure things out. And 3 weeks later, they don't trust each other. They don't like each other from all appearances. And you can correct me on any of this, okay? I still think there's going to be some of the bottom feeders in the SEC and the Big Ten that eventually are going to be like, hey, you know what? You guys just need to go home. And we have a better opportunity over here or over there. Am I wrong on any of this?
Well, certainly that things are not great between the Mountain West and the Pac-12. There's significant animosity, and I would argue that it began well before the Pac-12 took those four Mountain West schools. In fact, part of the reason the Pac-12 took those schools, or the reason they joined the Pac-12, was because things had broken down between the two conferences. The Mountain West was driving a hard line with that scheduling agreement for football, and that led to, you know, some hurt feelings and some wandering eyes. So
that was in August, right? If we're going to go back.
Well, yeah, but it was in August, but it had been
building,
simmering. It had been building for a while.
Okay.
The bottom feeders in the SEC and Big Ten getting booted out of their conferences because the big boys don't want to share the money. I think that's going to happen, but we're a few years away.
Hmm.
All of this is setting up to, like, if you're putting your doomsday clock, probably 2029, 2030, because of the expiration of the TV deals. You know, it's hard for these schools to leave 3, 4, 5 years before their TV deals end because the penalties are so steep, hundreds of millions of dollars. But as you get towards the last 18 months of a TV deal, the penalty for, you know, it's like 1 year of a penalty. The Big Ten's TV deal ends in the summer of 2030. Somewhere in late 28, early 29, the Big Ten will start to think about what do we want to be for our next TV deal. That's when you could start to see movement, either schools getting kicked out, schools being brought in, or the Big Ten and the SEC getting together, creating, you know, was described to me as an AFC and an NFC type of deal. Mm-hmm. And moving forward with basically two tiers in college football, the two of them and then everybody else.
Couldn't that be accelerated, though? Because you're right, there's penalties here and there. But if you make an AFC and an NFC, the dollars would be too big. They'd be too big. They'd be like, okay, yeah, we have to pay it. It's like Grand Canyon in the Pac-12. Stu Jackson's head of the WCC. He's very close with Jerry Colangelo, who's on the board of directors at GCU. This just isn't brain surgery that Jerry said, we're going to go to the WCC. And what are we, 3 months later, 4 months later? No, we're going to go Pac-12. Like, it can go that quick, John.
It can. ESPN Fox control most of the chess pieces because they've got the Big Ten and the SEC locked into those contracts. If they are willing to rip everything up, and let college football reform in a, with a mini NFL and then everybody else, it could happen sooner. But ESPN and Fox would have to be convinced that the best business move for them would be to rip up these contracts. And I would argue they probably feel like they've got good deals. ESPN has got the SEC signed through 2034. Are they going to feel like in 2027, 2028 that, you know what, it's in our best interest business-wise to void the last 6-7 years of these deals? Maybe they will, depending on what's out there. But that's the real calculation, is will the networks let the conferences out of their contracts?
John Wilner with us for a few minutes. Okay, over on the Gonzaga side, in Pac-12 expansion, what do you make of it?
It's a home run. I mean, it's a walk-off grand slam for the Pac-12, given the options, given where things were, right? Certainly, the Pac-12, Washington State, Oregon State, they would rather have the old Pac-12 still together.
Sure.
But based on the array of scenarios out there, getting Gonzaga was at the top of the list because it is a brand. The reason the SEC wanted Texas and Oklahoma, they are brands. The reason the Big Ten wanted USC, brand. Gonzaga is a basketball brand that generates audience nationally, eyeballs nationally, TV revenue, NCAA tournament revenue. So that elevates the stature of the reformed Pac-12 to the point where now there's a lot of options. They're getting a lot of interest, even from some schools that are publicly saying we're not interested. We'll see what happens. My guess is that they're going to go to the TV networks and say, okay, you know, we have the 7 football schools in Gonzaga. What are you going to pay, essentially? And then that will dictate where they go next, because they still do need one more football school, one more full-time member to meet the NCAA certification requirement. They have time to do it, but Gonzaga opens up so many possibilities for them that it was a huge get.
Last week, we talked at length about Grand Canyon University and the potential, and there's a lot swirling around with GCU and the Pac-12. Do you think that is one of the main options? They don't have football. They don't have football. Yep. I know, but as a basketball program, they've always wanted to be Gonzaga. And I would make the argument they're on the front end of that wish.
They are. They are going to – I'm sure the WCC is going to look to them to become the new Gonzaga once the Zags are out. My understanding is that Grand Canyon is not on the A-list of scenarios for the Pac-12 at this point. But that could change based on – the feedback the conference gets from its potential TV partners as to which direction to go. I think that it's more of a plan B, and I put St. Mary's in that category too. Very good basketball programs.
Right.
But I think they're kind of hitting pause. All right, let's see what's out there. Let's see if there are some moves with football schools, because they still need to get that football playing member. That's the issue. I think that's why Grand Canyon is kind of plan B. All right, let's get the football member, and then if we want to add basketball, more basketball, we can. And Grand Canyon would probably be near the top there. But because they still need that football member, I think that's why Grand Canyon is on the plan B list.
Texas State, the number one option then?
I don't think it's the number one option. I think the number one option is to see if they can get some of the schools that turned them down last week.
Like?
Memphis, South Florida, Tulane, UTSA, the schools that are in the American Conference, I'm not 100% sure that they have signed binding agreements at this point. And I know the Pac-12 is getting a lot of inbound calls, and those calls are picking up after Gonzaga. And I suspect that those American schools would be willing to listen, but it's got to be worth it for the Pac-12 financially. You know, Memphis, the bar for those schools to get out of the American is $25 million per school. Pac-12 is not paying $25 million. Now, could they reach some kind of deal at 5 or 10? Maybe, but we'll see. The financial piece is really important. But I would not rule out the possibility that schools that have already said no aren't secretly on the phone saying, come back to us with an offer and we'll think about it.
Brett, you're Mark a loser in Gonzaga.
No, I don't think so, because the Big 12, they were not ready to add Gonzaga for a bunch of reasons right now. Gonzaga is still going to be on the table for them in 2030. The Big 12's TV deal ends in the summer of 2031, 1 year after the Big 10's TV deal. Gonzaga will be there. They're not going to sign a deal with the Pac-12 that locks them in beyond that 2030, 2031 window. Everybody, including Boise State football, San Diego State football and basketball, everybody wants to have flexibility when that rupture happens. And what is college sports going to look like if the Big Ten and SEC do kind of form their own deal? Everybody else wants to be in the next best thing. So nobody is signing agreements with the Pac-12 that last beyond 5 years, basically, right? The agreements start in the summer of 2026. They're going to last basically five fiscal years. Everybody will have flexibility at that point.
John Wilner with us for a few minutes. We look ahead to the weekend in college football. Michigan, Washington at the start of the season look like an, oh my gosh, have to see football game. Is it still the case given the way both teams have played so far? Is it just two big brands? Of course, Brad, it's Washington, Michigan, or is it, it's still a good game?
I think it's still a good game, partly because you never see Michigan on the West Coast. I think this is their second regular season game on the West Coast in three or four decades. So to that point, it's pretty cool. Just like Ohio State coming out to Eugene next week, right? Getting those big 10 teams out on the West Coast is a big deal. In terms of implications, Washington's got two losses. Michigan's got run off the field by Texas. I wouldn't say the stakes are high level either for the Big Ten title or the playoff. But because there's 12 teams, Michigan's still alive. I'm very interested. I'm going to that game. I'm very interested in it. I think it's a great setup for Washington. Michigan's not very good. They can't throw the ball, right? I mean, you would have thought a few weeks ago, Michigan would have been a big favorite. Now, the Wolverines are the underdog because they can't throw. Well, Washington's got to be able to stop the run, which USC could not do against Michigan. But the Huskies have got a great chance to win.
Okay, so at the start of the year, if I would have said we're talking about games, we would have talked about Michigan and Washington. John, we're going to talk about a game that College Game Day is going to show up to.
Yes.
Of course, we're going to talk about Cal hosting Miami of Florida. Yes. But here's this Miami of Florida brand that's rebirthed. Here's Cal now in the ACC. It's West Coast. It's late night. It's all the TV would want. Are you surprised that this is a national game, Cal-Miami? What do you expect?
Part of the reason it's a national game is because of the options for game day. They pick the best location that week. To be honest, this isn't a great week for games. I think that the other might have been Tennessee, Arkansas. I think that Missouri, Texas A&M. Right. It's not a great lineup. So that's part of the calculation that ESPN makes where to put game day. But the bottom line is the Hurricanes are undefeated. They're in the top 10. Cal's 3-1. They've never gone to Berkeley for game day, so it's a chance to go to a new place. It's an ACC school. ESPN is all in with the ACC. Makes sense there. I really like the situation for Cal competitively. They're coming off a bye. Miami's coming off that crazy win over Virginia Tech where they got the overturn of the call on the last play. Great situation for Cal. And Cal has faced Mario Cristobal, the Miami coach, before when he was at Oregon. Yep. They did very well against him. They know Cam Ward because he was at Washington State. I think there's a great chance for Cal for a big upset. I think Cal students and fans will turn out at 6 a.m. on campus for the game day set. I would expect the guest picker to either be Jared Goff or Marshawn Lynch. You know, because Goff can do it. Goff, they played Monday. I think the Lions have a bye. The Lions have a bye week, so it could be Goff, could be Marshawn. We'll see. Should be a pretty good scene from Berkeley, though.
Justin Wilcox, one of the more underrated coaches, in my opinion, for what he has to work with.
Yes,
right there. What do you think? Why is it that he's stuck around? I know the Oregon job when it comes open. His name's always a part.
Yep.
His name was at Washington before it was Jed. Why is he stick around at Cal?
Part of it is lack of opportunity that he thinks is a no-brainer. If he had gotten offered the Washington job, probably would have taken it. Part of it, too, is he's kind of an old-school guy. Cal allows you to be a little old school. You have to do the transfer portal thing. You have to do NIL. But institutionally, you can't go all in with that stuff. There is an element of the old school way of coaching at Cal that probably doesn't exist at some other places because of the nature of the NIL world and the transfer portal world. He likes the Cal, what Cal is all about. Mm-hmm. You know, he coached there under Jeff Tedford back when Cal was really good with Rogers and Lynch. I think that's some of it, is he likes the old way of doing it, and that still exists to a certain point at Cal. That certainly restricts you competitively. They can't load up on transfers like Colorado can or Oregon can, but I think he enjoys that aspect of it. He's a good fit for them. They won't do any better than Justin Wilcox. He's a really good fit for them.
He's done great work up there. Before I get you out of here, let's talk about the hometown heroes in Tempe and Tucson. What do you make out of the Devils and Wildcats, U of A coming off the stunner up in Salt Lake City? I saw you wrote about them in bowl scenarios, I think a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, after they got blitzed at Kansas State. It was like, what's going on here? Let's just get over to basketball season. What do you make out of the Cats now and the Sun Devils?
That was a huge win for Arizona. Big win for Brent Brennan. Big win for the program. They had kind of staggered through the first few weeks. They're undefeated in Big 12 play. The path is open for them to win the Big 12, to make the playoff. I was very impressed in that environment. That said, Utah was without Cam Rising. It's not the same Utah team without Rising. So I put some stock in how Arizona performed, not necessarily everything I had. ASU, huge game this week. I would argue it's a must-win game for them in terms of getting into a bowl. The fact that we're talking about ASU on October 2nd, potentially getting into a bowl, it's a testament to what Kenny Dillingham has done thus far. But if you look at their schedule, it is really hard. Kansas was supposed to be very good. They're a mess, right? Quarterback play, other stuff going on. They've lost four in a row. They haven't beaten a major college team yet. They have a victory over Lindenwood. So this is a great
John, what is the nickname of Lindenwood?
I don't have any.
I can look it up right now on here, but I'm not going to do that.
They're in the Ohio Valley Conference, FCS.
Someone will yell at me about this. Someone will say you shouldn't make fun of poor Lindenwood. But look,
undoubtedly,
this is the only win at the football banquet. The end of the year, we beat Lindenwood. Go Jayhawks.
So far, that's their only win.
It's
a great chance for ASU coming off a bye. If they can get the fourth win, the road to the postseason is not open, but not wide open, but it's like a one way. Half the road is open. If they lose, then they still need three more wins to get bowl eligible. And you just look at that schedule and you see road games in Cincinnati and Stillwater, and you see BYU, and you see Arizona, and you see, I think it's Kansas State, Iowa State, one of those. It's a really hard schedule. They've got to get this win to make their bowl math manageable.
BYU is the surprise of the college football season, in my humble opinion.
They are right near the top. Army-Navy being undefeated is pretty cool, but certainly BYU at 5-0, nobody would have figured. Picked 13th in the Big 12. You know, they blew Kansas State's doors off. The win at SMU looks real good. They were in control against Baylor. They have been very impressive. I think BYU is a contender in the Big 12. The Holy War, it could have title stakes for both teams. Who would have figured?
John Wilner, good stuff as always. We'll see you next week.
Thanks very much.
All right, let's get into a deep dive. We're at the quarter pole of the college football season. So Coach Todd Graham is with us for a few minutes. Of course, coach at Arizona State, as many of you know, and is now a senior advisor at TCU. But you do want to get back on the sidelines, right?
Oh, absolutely. There's nothing like it.
Okay, quarter pole of the season, Coach Graham. What do you see on the field that you like, that's maybe a bit concerning? You're like, Brad, I did not expect this out of the gate. Maybe it's a team or two. Let's just talk big picture college football.
Yeah, there's been some surprises. I mean, obviously, I've spent most of my time watching the Big 12. And, you know, BYU's been a huge surprise. And, you know, obviously predictions are just predictions. And then I think the Big 12 Conference, you know, you look at the top 25, there's, yeah, I think it's like the first team in our league is like 15th or 16th. And so it kind of reminds me of the old Pac-12 where we all beat each other up. And that's what kind of seems what's happening. And but that's kind of been a surprise. But I'll tell you, watching the Alabama-Georgia game is one of the best football games I think I've ever seen. Not a whole bunch of surprises, but I think Colorado's a big surprise. I mean, for them to do what they did last week to Central Florida, and Central Florida, you know, Gus Malzahn's one of my guys from my coaching tree and that I know very well. And they have one of the most talented teams in the Big 12. So Colorado's been a surprise. I think BYU's been a surprise. But, I think things have been pretty pretty steady as far as the SEC and the Big Ten. But Alabama wasn't a surprise to me because I've coached against Kalen DeBoer at when I was at Hawaii. He was at Fresno. And I think that Alabama is that was impressive. Performance by them, but I'm not surprised by that at all. I think he's got a great coaching staff and a great football coach. And everybody kind of anticipated that Georgia would just dominate them, but not so. You know, Alabama's kind of had Georgia's number, and I think Kalen kind of showed that he's ready for that job.
You know, Coach, it's interesting, the CFP, as we're going through this first year, you and I can sit here in the first week of October, and maybe not, we can say, okay, of the 12, there's 8, 9. Like, I think Alabama and Georgia are probably going to play each other again somewhere before we get to, or maybe it is in the championship game. That's just the way things go. Doesn't mean that that game last week wasn't terrific. It was. But it's kind of a prelude now in this new world that we're in. What do you make out of the CFP so far? I know it's early, but we're going to start seeing these projections. What do you make out of it?
Well, it's so different than before. When you're trying to get into the Final Four, is totally different. And, you know, one of the things that happens, people are in the same conferences, so people play each other. And they kind of beat each other up. And then who's going to end up with those final 12 spots? And what's important, I think, is you don't want to be going into the last 3 or 4 weeks and not be in that top 12 ranking. And so the conferences that beat each other up mm-hmm. are going to have teams that are going to be, lower down in the ranking is going to be interesting, because that's where the controversy is going to be. It's not going to be in the ones at the top, the conference champions and all that. It's going to be those who gets those last, three or four slots.
A team like BYU has gotten off to such a great start on one side of the street. The other side of the street, you know Mike Norvell well. It's been a very difficult season at Florida State. But in the way that this is set up, it looks like there's no way, no chance, no how. But you just don't know when a team can get on a roll. And if teams are eating each other up at the start of the year, Clemson, everybody said Clemson's got no shot. Well, here we are now. They look like they're on a roll. So it is the week by week in this, and it's not too late.
No, it's not. But I'll tell you, football is so unique. What makes it unique is the physicality of it. And you look at, if a team can be riding high and then they get in week 8 and their quarterback gets hurt. Man, last year Mike got his quarterback hurt and that kept him out of the playoff. And so, being healthy, keeping a team healthy and improvement every single week, and then kind of how you're built. If you could, there's not going to be a whole lot of teams that make that playoff that can't play defense. And there's not going to be a lot of teams that make that playoff that can't run the football, which is going to affect scoring. So, scoring offense, scoring defense, those are the things that are big. But I'm telling you, staying healthy and having a healthy football team is something that, over that long period of time, that 13-week season is a challenge. And then you take the conference championship game on top of that.
Yep.
how all that affects it, you know, that's the key. You know, I mean, I you know, Dan, I'm really close to Dan at Oregon, and man, I went and spent a week with them and watched them. And I said, them and Texas, I thought are the two teams that are going into new conferences that I thought really had positioned themselves to be a, make a big run into the playoff. And they start off slow, and they're but you see how quickly they've gotten better. So it's the team coaching matters, development matters, how you build your team matters. Obviously, you see what's happening to Mike at Florida State. You know, the NIL and the transfer portal. You know, you can make some personnel mistakes. I'm not saying that's what he did, but how fragile rosters are from one year to the next. Are you going to remake your roster every year? There's a big margin for a big swing from year to year. Whereas if, you know, I think the people that really still build their team with people, whether they're high school players or transfer players or college players, I don't believe that you can build team and you can develop a team and a disciplined team without having at least 24 months of training the same guys. So you know that. I mean, when you have a senior team that's got guys been starting for 3 and 4 years, man, it makes a world of difference. And so I think that's what you're seeing, and people are trying to evolve and understand and deal with the transfer portal, because you can in the spring have great transfers and win the media and you had all this great class and you don't get them developing, playing together. You don't have the right formula that fits you. And to me, the formula that's going to win year in and year out, it doesn't matter where you're at in college football over the last 25 years. You got to play defense and you got to be able to run the football. And so really running the football, and obviously you look the other night, being able to score. I mean, dynamic players, obviously, you look at Alabama and, you know, 17-year-old receiver doing that. I was like, wow. I mean, you know, but, you know, that also goes back to, you know, I hate – the one thing I do hate about the transfer portal and all this NIL stuff is people really, playing for a team and believing in that team. And, you know, I don't know. I think it's tough. If you're at three different schools in 3 different years, I don't know that you can be the best player that you can be. But obviously that's the choices that they have. But I know when you're putting together a roster and you're building a roster, personnel – more than ever, and it's always been the number one thing, is vital in how you go about building your team and how you go about doing that.
Todd Graham with us for a couple of minutes as we talk college football inside and out with the coach, senior advisor at TCU this year, of course, longtime coach in the college football scene. I'm curious, Todd, about the way a roster is put together. You alluded to it a little bit earlier. You have a coach like Dabo Swinney, who is really staying away from the portal for the most part. At the start of the season, he's just getting crushed because, well, the game's passed him by. And now he's got a team playing well, and they've all come together because, to your point, they've been together. There's that side of it in building a roster. And then there is that guy over in that locker is making X amount of money and I should be making this amount of money. And that's a new dynamic on the college space. How do you work that together?
Well, hopefully they're going to help us out a little bit. And, you know, when they, you know, this court case, this ruling comes out and they start actually paying players, where you actually say, okay, this is how much money you have, like a salary cap. And there becomes some equity, you'll be an equity between one school and the next on how much money each person has to basically fill a roster. I think that's going to affect roster size, because you surely can't pay 105 players. Are you going to have 105 players on scholarships? I think you're going to see roster sizes decrease because of cost. How does that affect, you know, how are you going to build that? In other words, and when I went to I spent some time at Alabama last year before their season last spring with Coach Saban before this last fall, and just visiting them and how they structured things was, if you were the starting quarterback, you know, they made so much money. If you're starting tailback, made so much money. And it wasn't, you know, other teams that I advised with, they would have a recruit, say a running back. He was a top running back. They said, okay, we're going to pay you this. And he's making more than the starting running back that's at the program now. That's where you can't have that stuff. And then it just gets to be, instead of guys thinking about team and, hey, if we put the team first and I ourselves and take up the team and the team wins, then all of our goals get met, right? There's too much focus on individuality and the individual needs and not the team's need. I think Dabo is showing that his philosophy of building a roster is showing that it's proven its dividends right now. I personally think that it's a combination of that. I think you have to have a core nucleus on your football team of guys that that come in as freshmen and got them 4 or 5 years. They build affinity, you build character, you build elite discipline and structure and train them. And then you might add to your roster, you know, kind of like almost like basketball. If basketball, you go add one or two dynamic players. I think in football, if you can go out there and add, you know, a pass rusher, a guy that can cut a cover corner, a dominant, you know, running back, a difference maker, receiver, and quarterback. So it might be, when you look at the roster each year, of bringing in and having some difference makers that fit who you are. I think that's the biggest thing. It's not just about talent, physical talent. A team has to be cohesive and they have to play together as one. I think you've seen that in Alabama, Georgia. Wow. I mean, you want to talk about an unbelievable, both teams showing character, heart, elite discipline, obviously great playmaker ability. But, you know, there's not but, you know, five, six teams in the country that recruit at the level that they have the resources that they have. Mm-hmm. So I think it's kind of a combination. But I think if you go out there and you're going to come back and have 25 different guys every year on your roster, that's going to be really difficult to do. And so to me, if I got a head coaching job right now, the number one person that I would sit down and start to hire, for me, before, the number one thing I was going to hire is a strength coach. And that strength coach is who spends 80% of the time with the players and trains and develops our players, who's basically the associate head coach. And that guy's going to be versed in personnel. Mm-hmm. He's got to understand personnel and going to be involved in evaluating everybody. And then really, 1A right now for me would be a general manager, would be a person that's experienced. You see, Alabama just invested coordinator pay in a GM, a person that is year-round working to put that roster together, to know the dynamic. Because the key about building a roster is assessment and evaluation of your present roster. What are the strengths and weaknesses? You know, my deal was we had it broke down the offensive line in physical, mental, emotional, academic, football smarts. Here's where we're at. So why would we add somebody that accentuates our weaknesses instead of someone that, you know, if we're weak in this area, we need to make sure we add to that, we build a profile for what we're wanting in that particular spot, because you don't have that many spots, contrary to belief. And so that to me, if I got a head coach job, the number one thing I want to hire me is someone that can evaluate personnel. And let me tell you this, I've known a lot of great football coaches that are great teachers, great play callers, that aren't great personnel evaluators. I micromanaged that when I was a head coach. I was our lead recruiter, lead evaluator. And because there's so many intangibles that come into that, and I wanted my team to look, play, and appear, when you see, I wanted them to have elite discipline, elite character, so what I was coaching them mattered. And then I wanted a team that was fast and explosive. Well, obviously, with coaching, everybody wants a team like that. Well, you got to recruit to that. And so if you get three or four guys in the same position that's careless, right, that maybe, you know, you can't save everybody, you know, and you get so that when you're building a roster, I think the number one thing, if I got to be a head coach, is going to hire a great evaluator, a great GM, and then I'd go hire me a great strength coach, great offensive coordinator. Obviously, I ran the defense, but the next thing would probably be a defensive coordinator. And that's really one of the reasons why I did run the defense, because I couldn't afford to keep Mike Norvell if I paid an offensive coordinator. So I paid Mike Norvell $1.2 million because, you know, I was doing the defense and I did not have to pay a defensive coordinator. So I used that money to hire a strength coach. So a lot of people don't understand how those decisions are made. But if you're at the top of the rung in finances, it's different than being in the middle or the bottom. And so you got to learn how to do more with less when you're down here. And so hopefully with the court case that's coming out and they say, OK, here's how much money you have. That's going to help and at least making a little bit more equal a playing field, because right now it's just the wild, wild west when it comes to NIL and, you know, how much people are getting paid, and there's really no knowledge. Someone can tell you they're making something, they might not be making it. I mean, it's just crazy. It's really insane the way it's operating right now.
One other thing, I'll get you out here, and I appreciate your time. Todd Graham with us for a few minutes. So if there is you're a head coach once again at some point, and you say, I need this wide receiver, but I may not be at that program that has the upper echelon of dollars, and you've got to go sit with a booster. You've got to go sit with somebody that's going to bring that money in because you need that wide receiver. Let's just say the wide receiver doesn't work out. The booster says, well, wait a minute. You said you needed this. So I'm not saying this directly to Utah, but I think we're in this space now where a coach can go ask for the money. The player doesn't work out. The booster says, I don't want to do this anymore. Or that coach doesn't know what he's doing. And maybe the coach is right all along. Separate that whole dynamic because that's out there now.
Yeah, it's difficult. And here's one of, to me, the biggest issue. Let's say I go and I say, okay, Brad, you're my donor. And man, I've got to have this wide out. I got to have this quarterback. He's awesome. Can take us to the next level. You go write me a check for $1 million. Okay. And that's what we're going to do. And then it comes back and he doesn't work out and he's not starting. That's where the problem is. And that's why the schools that are able to go out and have a definitive plan. I think it has to do with, you know, looking at being able to involve, you know, small businesses, corporations, and be able to build enough in there where you're not actually being reactive. What I mean by that, if I'm going out, I know I got to get this kid and I got to go ask this donor for that money. I need to be ahead of the game more than that. And what's happening right now, to kind of give you an idea, in the Big 12, is that you've got schools that are in there around $10, $15 million in NIL. You got people down below $4 million. Mm-hmm. And then you got people at the very top, okay, like, you know, the Georgias, Alabamas, the Texas, that don't even have a ceiling. And so that's where the challenge is. And to me, even before when we had facilities, right? That's one of the reasons why we built the facilities at Arizona State, so we could be on an equal playing field, right? Well, now, if you're not invested as a program, if you don't have a complex business plan and you're not raising money and developing money and putting in the NIL, and the problem is everybody keeps saying donor. Your donors, you still need your donors to build facilities. You still need your donors to help build capital projects, to train and develop your players. Well, you're asking them for $1 million and you have to go every year. There's the fatigue, that donor fatigue that's happening. So you got to have more masses amount of people. To me, you got to build a matrix. You take Arizona State. It's the largest alumni. Think about how many small businesses there are. Well, you got to be able to develop that and activate those people to support. And they see that their money's making a difference, right? Therefore, you have to win. You have to have success. And then to do that, because that's kind of what happened when we were at Arizona State. Mm-hmm. We came in, we won 8 games, and then back-to-back 10-win seasons. I didn't start raising money, Brad, until we got halfway through that 14 season. And because I'd won, I delivered a product, I could activate people, and then we're able to go out and activate. And what we did was activate the people at the top. And that was great. We did some great things doing that with the facilities. But to me, it has to be much larger than that. And it can't be, I would never want to go out and be saying, hey, Brad, I want you to give me this amount of money because I'm going to sign this particular player. Yeah. It's really building a nest egg where you can be in a competitive range with the teams you're competing with, and then maxing out those dollars. Once this court case comes down, hopefully they'll regulate it and say, hey, here's the salary cap. Because if they never have a salary cap, man, it's going to be difficult, because there's teams out there right now that do not have a ceiling. most teams out there right now, the vast majority, and I'm talking, there's might be, you know, 5 to 7 teams that don't have a ceiling, but the vast majority of people are somewhere in that $8 to $20 million area. And if you're not in that area, and that encompasses a lot of teams probably in the Big 12, that you're below that, you're going to have a very difficult time. And recruiting matters. Relationships still matters, right? People want to play for a coach. But if you're not even in the ballpark, you know, it's like when I was coaching Arizona State, they said, why are you losing your coaches? Well, yeah, the ones I lost to head coach, there's nothing I can do about that. And I wanted those things to happen. But the ones that really hurt were the ones that I lost to. They took this D-line job to this D-line job.
Mm-hmm.
And they doubled their salary. You just can't compete with that. And it's the same thing when you're dealing with this NIL. You know, kids are, you know, a lot of kids that we're recruiting and stuff. I mean, you know, those things are families and stuff that it impacts them. So, you know, I think if you could get that there and you could get that attention away from all that and you develop a sound roster pay scale, I think staff's going to look a lot more like NFL staffs. You're going to have personnel, roster management, salary cap management, right? And then you're going to have guys that are coaching and teaching. Because I used to find that coaches were so busy recruiting, so busy coaching, chasing after their kids academically to make sure they're getting things done, right? I mean, they really didn't have time to learn how to be great evaluators. So that's why I micromanage that. So that's an interesting dynamic in how people manage that. You see Georgia, Alabama, Texas, those people, Oregon, they've got a lot of people. They're managing those rosters and they've got great resources. And you're seeing that. The ones that are out there that are doing it, that the more with less, are the ones that to me are really, really impressive.
Todd, as always, I appreciate your time and insight. Stay safe. Good luck this week.
All right. Thanks so much, Brad.